Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, remembering the life of Jonathan Winters.
Right now, Johnny, I feel like Ralph Edwards because the next man I'm going to introduce is somebody out of your past. Remember when you were a kid in public school back in Norfolk, Nebraska? Well, here's one of your old classmates, Mr. Willis Mumford. Oh, God love you. What's that reason? I feel like a fool, in these coveralls. Arnold Stebler drove me around in a semi-truck for the past 15 hours, and he said we were supposed to meet down at the barn, and there's a surprise for you there. I just want to tell you this. The guys feel different about you. If you was to come home now, they'd just beat the life out of you. So don't come back to Norfolk right away. I remember, you know, I guess you do too. At the high school, you know, Johnny was, he started out, he was in all kinds of things. He was in everything. One thing he wanted to be more than anything, he used to tell me, I was one of his best buddies at the time, and him and me would go out into an open field, and we'd just look up and talk to one another and everything, and he says, you know what, I'd rather be more than anything in the world is a magician. And so he started magic, and he gave himself a name, the Great Carsoni, and he thought on that real hard. And he'd take a little, we didn't have no bunnies, and so he took a squirrel and dyed it white. And pulled it out, you know, and the people go, that's a white squirrel. the fact that you've been able to make two wives disappear Listen, you take care of yourself. Wonderful to see you.
That, of course, was Jonathan Winters as Willis Mumford on Dean Martin's Celebrity Roast from 1973. Laughing prominently in the clip is roastee Johnny Carson. That kind of bellowing laugh was often the response to many of the characters brought to life by Winters, who passed away on April 11th of natural causes. Jonathan Winters was born in Dayton, Ohio on November 11th, 1925. He went to school in Springfield and at the age of 17 joined the Marine Corps. He served 2.5 years in the South Pacific, came back to Ohio, and attended Kenyon College in Central Ohio. The comedian also had an interest in art that led him to the Dayton Art Institute, where he studied for over 2 years. It's there that he first met his wife of more than 60 years. Eileen Winters died in 2009 following a long battle with breast cancer. Writer and director Murray Horowitz says that Winters missed his wife dearly. Horowitz is also a Dayton native. He was in town last week, and we had a chance to sit down and talk about his friend Jonathan. Horowitz met Winters over the telephone in the early 70s, and later they became good friends. But for Horowitz, the relationship began much earlier.
The honest way of putting this is that we met when probably I was about 6 years old and Jonathan was on television. He had a 15-minute show on, I think, CBS. It was in the evening or afternoon. I remember being in my grandmother's apartment on North Broadway, literally the same block as the Wright Brothers cycle shop. And I remember seeing this guy on television, and my brother Jeff told me, oh yeah, sure, that's Jonathan Winters. And my mom saying, oh, you know, and he's from Dayton. And I was strangely affected even at that age, 6, 7, 8 years old, whatever I was. Then as I became interested more and more in comedy, and it was a great time to be interested in comedy because everybody made comedy records. I memorized Shelley Berman routines and Dick Gregory routines and Bob Newhart routines and Jonathan Winters. And I loved mimicry. I mean, from the time I was about 2 or 3 years old, I was doing, you know, Johnny Ray impersonations, Frankie Lane impersonations. So I went to school with the master, with Jonathan. But when we met for the first time, it was actually on the phone. Like Jonathan, I was from Dayton. Like Jonathan, I went to Kenyon College, although as John used to be fond of saying, but Murray graduated. I began my career right after Kenyon as a clown on the Ringling Brothers Barnum & Bailey Circus. And while I was on the Ringling show, I had this great urge to get in touch with Jonathan and to meet him and to be mentored by him. And I saw in the Kenyon Alumni Bulletin that Jonathan had done some commercials for a Kenyon alumnus who lived in Akron, Ohio, a guy named Bob Iredell. And I called Bob Iredell, and he said, well, sure. He said, here's Jonathan's manager's name, and call him. And by 1972, this must have been 71 or 72, I'd gotten in touch with the manager. The manager put me in touch with Jonathan, and I remember waiting in my cousin's apartment in Los Angeles for a call from Jonathan Winters. And sure enough, he called me, and we had a great time on the phone. This would have been then, I guess, around September, October of 72, and we promised to get together when he was going to be in Cincinnati or Dayton. The Reds were honoring him in the offseason in December, and he ended up not coming. But we were in kind of light touch over the next 5 years, and I tried very hard to get Kenyon to give Jonathan an honorary degree because he had never graduated, but Kenyon meant a lot to him. And I was finally successful. It was awarded on Honors Day, an Honors Day convocation in 1980. And the good thing about that was Jonathan was the only speaker. It wasn't like commencement where there are all these people getting honorary degrees. And he was terrific. He was very funny. And we met. We spent a lot of time together and hit it off.
Tell me a little bit about the beginning of that relationship. What kind of things did you do? I'm sure you talked a lot about comedy.
Yeah, I mean, I think he took pity on me and befriended me, but here was a kid from Dayton and a kid from Kenyon who was a clown in the Ringling Brothers Barnum & Bailey Circus. That was kind of interesting, you know. And then by the time we met face to face, I had already made my bones, so to speak, because I had a hit show on Broadway, Ain't Misbehavin', that I had co-written. So I was a Tony Award winner, and so I guess he thought I was worthy of notice. But John was very down with it, and Jonathan was one of those people like Louis Armstrong who, if you were the president of the United States or you were some kid buying an ice cream cone, he'd talk to you the same way. I mean, he was always holding forth and always very honest. So when you were with John, I mean, as much as I talk, I didn't talk much because Jonathan would hold forth, but it was always worth it. We talked about Dayton a lot. We talked about Kenyon. He talked a little bit more about Springfield because, you know, I think he moved to Springfield. His parents got divorced. He was about 7 or 8 years old, and then he moved to Springfield. And we talked about comedy a lot. And he laid down some principles that, not surprisingly, I was very much in sympathy with because I had – it's not surprising because I was like him, liberally educated, and like him, you know, he had taught me through his records and his TV shows. And that is, he was not about making jokes. I mean, he wasn't Bob Hope or Phyllis Diller just going through joke files and doing one-liners. He was out to tell the truth. And that's what he used to say, tell the truth and people will laugh.
So for this man who was very funny, but truth was at the heart of his humor, his characters were developed around people he knew growing up. Did you talk to him about those characters?
Yeah, I did. There was a character named Maud Frickert. Call me Maudie. And everybody at Kenyon thought that Jonathan had based that on a woman named Dorothy who owned a kind of tavern in Gambier, Ohio, on the campus of Kenyon, or actually Kenyon was in Gambier, called Dorothy's Lunch. And he didn't really remember that, he said. He said he based it on a number of women, some of them from his family. If you listen to it, I mean, any of us who grew up in Ohio recognizes Maud Frickert as we recognize Elwood P. Suggins. So, I mean, I think to a certain extent they are not generic but agglomerations of types that he knew. I mean, when Elwood P. Suggins talks about having a car he made with iron tires, I mean, we seen that boy. You know, we knew who he was.
What are some of your favorite skits of his?
Jonathan had an album long out of print called Whistle Stopping with Jonathan Winters, which was, I think, the 1964 presidential campaign. It was either 64 or 68. I think it was 64. And he got himself interviewed as different kinds of people in the electorate. So he always had a gay character, a male character. He always had Maudie Frickert. In Whistle Stopping, I remember he had the average American housewife, Sally Silly, or so, I don't know. And he had one of the most wonderful lines in there. The interviewer said, well, what kind of man would you like to be president? And Jonathan said, oh, I don't know, a kind man, a handsome man, a God-fearing man, not afraid of God, but if he does bad, God will get him. I mean, those are the kinds of things he just happened upon. And let's remember all of this, that not unlike Louis Armstrong, not unlike Sonny Rollins, not unlike Dizzy Gillespie, he was making it up. I mean, he was coming up with this stuff in an improvisatory manner, and that was what was truly, truly remarkable about him. And he was really good on film, I thought, in things like The Loved One and, of course, Mad, 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 Mad World and Russians Are Coming. But where he was really winging it, as he would say. I remember on a TV show, a commercial he did, Leo DeRocher, the ball player and baseball manager, was interviewing him and setting up. He did a piece as a baseball pitcher, and he did a pantomime only with sound effects. And he would throw the ball, and it was wonderful. He would wind up, he'd go, means the catcher, that's how fast the catcher returned the ball to him. It's like, you know, and then there was, you know, and then over the front fence it went. And then, hello there, sport fans. My name's Rip Ripley. Every day before a big game, I always eat some of these. Corn, he looked at the box, crunches. They're good for you. Make you strong. Give you strong breath. You just pour some in the bowl like this. And he poured them in the bowl. He says, these are, what are these things? Oh, them things that, yep, that's them things, all right. I mean, and he just improvised this commercial, and it was perfect. It was a perfect satire.
Did Jonathan ever talk to you about where he got his humor?
Jonathan talked to me a little bit about the sources of his humor. I guess it's possible to do a kind of Freudian two-step with Jonathan, because he really did not have a happy childhood. The great playwright Moss Hart used to say that he had a hunch. He wrote in his autobiography that show business and the theater was the refuge of people with unhappy childhoods. And I think that's more true than it is not true. Jonathan certainly came from as he once said, I read in one of his obituaries the other day, he said, I think it was my father hated my mother hated my father, so that made for a very interesting relationship, something like that. But it was not a happy upbringing. His father was an alcoholic. His father was a kind of he was a WASP, you know, had gone to Yale and like either busted out or just made it through with a gentleman's C or something. Jonathan never had anything good to say about his father. And his mother I have heard read interviews where he said that, you know, his mother was quick, and his mother did have a talk show on, I think, WIZE in Springfield, a radio show. So he clearly got some of the performing ability from his mom. But it was a testy, horrible relationship. It ended in divorce when John was like 7 or 8. But despite this, he came from a wealthy family. I mean, his father kind of frittered away the family. It was the Winters National Bank, which many of your listeners, our listeners, will recall. I had my first checking account at the Winters Bank. But he did have, I thought he told me it was his grandfather, Valentine Winters. But if he was Jonathan Harshman Winters III, that doesn't make sense. So I'm not sure. But at any rate, there was somebody who his grandpa, he said, was funny and used to make fun, used to do impersonations of some of the characters around Dayton. And he was clearly, I never heard him say anything bad about his grandfather. His mother was jealous of his success. His mother, in fact, famously was on the Jack Parr show, and Jack Parr interviewed her with John sitting right there and expected her to say some wonderful things about John. And she turned to John and said, "You're the biggest joke I ever wrote," or something. It was just horrible, insulting her own son on national television. So I think when I say you can do a kind of Freudian two-step with him, I mean, you know, maybe some of that humor is born of pain. I think there's something to that. Those of us who work in comedy have a little – within some context, even if it's a comfortable middle-class context such as the one I grew up in Dayton, we have some knowledge of suffering, some knowledge of pain, of being, you know, the kid whom they made fun of on the playground, the kid who could never play ball. And Jonathan, even though Jonathan was a good athlete, I think, you know, he was the funny kid and he was always the outsider.
I heard that you might be able to tell me a story about when Jonathan Winters was introduced to Orville Wright.
I asked Jonathan one time if he ever knew Orville Wright, because my family had a connection to Orville Wright. My dad was a physician on Broadway and Third, and his office was right across the street from Mr. Wright's laboratory. And in fact, so my brothers actually met Orville Wright. He died before I was born, and he died in 1948, I think. But my father was actually, when Mr. Wright collapsed at his work table, my father was summoned and put him in the ambulance and called his doctor and got him to Miami Valley Hospital. So if you're reading biographies of Orville Wright, they'll say a doctor was summoned from across the street. That's my dad. So I told this story to Jonathan one time, and I asked him if he'd ever met Orville Wright. He said, "Oh yeah," and he said he was driving. He was probably about 8 or 9 years old, and he's driving down Jefferson Street, right? Where's the Engineers Club? Yeah, his father was driving. His grandfather was in the front seat, and his grandfather was this guy who would make fun of, you know, do impersonations of people around Dayton. And this sort of courtly older gent was crossing Jefferson Street. And Jonathan's grandfather said, "There's Orville Wright, that asshole." Just to this day, one of my favorite quotations in American culture. And Johnny said, "Orville Wright?" And he said, "Yeah, you want to meet him?" And, you know, little Jonathan said, "Sure." You know, I mean, if you grew up in Dayton in those days, you know, well into the 50s, I mean, Orville Wright was this like hero, you know. And he said, "Yeah." And so Mr. Winters rolled down his window and said, "Hey, Orv." And Orville Wright looked up. He said, "Come on over here and shake my grandson's hand." And Orville Wright reached into the window and shook little 8 or 9 year old Jonathan Winters' hand. And I love this country. Where else could Orville Wright and Jonathan Winters have shaken hands?
This is WISO Weekend on WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks for joining us. Today on the program, we're speaking with writer and director Murray Horowitz, who got to know Jonathan Winters in the early 70s. Horowitz and Winters also worked together. We have a clip from one of their improv acts at the Kenyon Festival Theater, Pirates Cove, 1981.
Hi, welcome to the Pirates Cove. Welcome to the Kenyon Festival Theater Comedy Cabaret. There is one word that should have been inserted in your programs and in what I just said. This is an improvisational comedy cabaret. It was a budget consideration. We couldn't put the word improvisational in. But that's important to us, and what it means is that nothing that you will see up here tonight has been written down. Nothing has been scripted. We're a little bit like jazz musicians who know what songs we're going to play. We're just not sure exactly how they're going to come out or how we're going to play them. So you'll see some things tonight that that have never been done before that we're making up just as we go along. That's the most important announcement that I have for you. We do have somebody who is right in the middle of the news as it happens. He's come up from the Port Columbus Airport. Jeez, if you're this much fun during an air traffic controller strike, you must be great during a tornado. He's one of the air traffic controllers been pressed into service by President Reagan. I'd like you to give him a warm welcome, Mr. Horace Hardbody. Mr. Hardbody. Being up there in the tower and, you know, watching the radar scanner, it must be incredible pressure, tension.
Hell yes.
What do you do to relieve that?
Well, go right on down the hall. I I take sedation. I do. As you can tell, my eyes are swollen twice their size. I'm talking about the pupils. And I'm not proud of that, but Doc Webler over at the pharmacy said you ought to have something.
Yeah.
And you're going to see a lot of stuff in there. And I have seen a lot of stuff. I've seen 46 twin Cessnas in a half hour. That's a lot. They should never have that many things up there on a Sunday. God damn people get up there, they go crazy, they're drunked up. One boy jumped out with a typewriter. What the hell do you think he's going to write going down? You know, if he had a sheet of paper doing this, you got to write fast. But he was dead. He died just south of Columbus. We had him on the scanner. Right. Scanner. I've seen so many things. I don't know what the hell a scanner is. But we've seen. I brought it myself, and I'm very proud of this. I didn't expect another stripe or anything. I brought in on my own. I brought in two United. I brought in Continental, which was supposed to land in Cincinnati. And they said there was heavy ground fog, and they said, "Come on in here." And by God, he come in like a shot. Yeah, he was out of gas. I looked in them windows, and them people were like, "Yes." Their eyes are bigger than any cannon. Oh, God, that's funny. Then I brought in two American flights, and there's a Delta. I don't know what that was doing on the scan there. I sent them over in Indianapolis, and they didn't want to go there, so I gambled and sent them up to Ottawa. Boy, well, you should see Canada. Damn it, you just can't go over a higher the rest of your life. Give them a chance for them people to see a beaver.
You've been now on the job for a few days, and the situation in regards to the air traffic controller strikes is a little stabilized. Would you now, guarantee the safety to the air passenger now? If it were up to you, how would you travel?
Boy, I tell you, let's see what it says. I'm supposed to read off this. Okay. Anything you're not sure of, do something about it. Read off of something. To my knowledge, it is very safe and will be safe. Am I talking into this?
That's right.
To my knowledge, it will be very safe for you to continue, for you and your loved ones to take off and land in an orderly manner, providing there are not other aircraft in the sky. Rest assured, even though we are not thoroughly qualified, your chances are 40-90. I don't know. Go Amtrak. Trains are more fundamental.
Comedian Jonathan Winters and our guest today, Murray Horowitz from 1981. Our conversation continues.
Let's talk briefly about Jonathan Winters' later years and what kind of contact did you have with him?
I probably was not a good son, Jonathan being my comedy father, as he was to many, many people, as you've read in obituaries, Robin Williams most notably. Bill Cosby called him the chairman of the board. Steve Martin, George Carlin, everybody, Jonathan was Big Daddy. So I'm like very insignificant. But Jonathan befriended many people. And I would go out and visit him in Montecito in Santa Barbara where he lived and stayed with him a couple of times. And his wife Eileen, who actually was a classmate of my uncle's at Dunbar High School in Dayton. No, Roosevelt, not Dunbar. And so we were very close. I called him pretty often. When you had to make time to call Jonathan, because when you call Jonathan, I had to be ready to play. So I would call him in character, and I would usually say that I was from Dayton, Ohio, or that I was calling for the United Jewish Appeal or something. So he'd instantly, or for Kenyon College, so he'd know who it was, and it wasn't a crank. Earlier on, Jonathan you know, you would call, and this was in the days before caller ID, you'd call and Jonathan would answer the phone and say, "We're in the vault. If you have money, I'll take it now. If you don't," I mean, he didn't know who was on the other end of the phone, but he would like, but usually I'd call up and say, "Mr. Winters, my name is Horwitz. I'm calling for United Jewish Appeal in Dayton, Ohio, and I thought that maybe you would," you know, and he would know, and then he'd start to play. My son, who's a film editor, was in Los Angeles, and he went up to Montecito to visit John one time, and he said, Jonathan would be sitting in a restaurant, and people would come up to him and say, are you Jonathan Winters? He'd say, yes. Oh, God, we love your comedy so much, and you've brought such joy to us and everything. And Jonathan would turn to him and say, "You know, if you had $38, it'd mean the world to me." And my son Alexander said, you know, what was brilliant was he didn't say, "Do you have $2?" Because they knew they'd know he was jiving, you know, they would know he was making fun. But he'd say, like, "If you had $26, I could really use it right now." It would be just enough to make people think he was telling the truth, you know. And they would say, "Gee, I had no idea." They'd walk away saying, "I had no idea he was in such bad shape," you know. So Jonathan loved holding forth. He loved the interaction with other people. And provided the people didn't try to one-up him, that was the mistake you could make and that comedians sometimes made with Jonathan, which is try to trade jokes with him or something and try to one-up him. He'd tear you apart. I mean, he'd just tear you apart because that's not what he was about. That's not what his comedy was about. And after all, he was Jonathan Winters. He's this saturnine figure. I love what Scott Simon said on his show about Jonathan. He said, if you use the word genius to apply to anybody but Albert Einstein, you'll get an argument. Well, Albert Einstein and Jonathan Winters.
I think in one of his last interviews in Springfield with a local reporter, he was not necessarily looking back with regret, but kind of longing for the loss. Some of his comrades, some of his people in his fellow comedians were gone, and he was feeling the impact of that. Is that your experience?
Yeah, I think Jonathan missed a lot of people. Most of all, and I really need to say this when you ask about his later years, most of all he missed his wife Eileen. Eileen died about, 2009, I think. And she had cancer several times. I mean, had it recovered. It was really, really tough. Jonathan, thankfully, went rather peacefully and quickly and was with it almost up till the very end. He really missed Eileen, and I think he went downhill reasonably quickly after Eileen died. They were married, after all, for 65 years or 63 years. I mean, it was a long, long relationship, and if not unique, rare in show business. You know, two kids from Dayton, Ohio, I think that's why. But Jonathan knew, he was very, very aware of what he had meant to American comedy. He was very, very proud of the fact that Jonathan, that Groucho Marx had said to him once, he said, "You're okay, kid. And you know why I like you?" He said, "You work clean and you tell the truth." And Jonathan was very, very proud of that. I mean, that Groucho Marx, you know, gave him the seal of approval.
I've been speaking with Murray Horowitz. And Murray, I guess I would just ask for your final comments about your relationship with Jonathan and what he's meant to you. And pay your tributes here to the man.
Oh, man. You will not get my final comments about Jonathan Winters, Jerry, because I'm not going to make my final comment will be it's to be hoped 80 years from now when I follow him in death. I mean, Jonathan, this is a very, very tough one for me personally. You know, everybody who dies, who meant something to us, you know, leaves a hole. This is a giant, giant hole. But also for the country, Jonathan's legacy is one that keeps on giving because the things that he believed in are things that and the things that he lived are things that will keep on living and nourishing us. He believed in telling the truth in comedy. He believed in people and in people being the source of humor. And he believed in improvisation and in just making it up on the spot and that something good would come of that. There is a spirit in the Miami Valley, I would say, of invention and of industry. We're the people who invented the airplane. We're the people who invented the cash register. You know, we did a lot of these. We invented the self-starter for the car. And we invented Jonathan Winters. I mean, Jonathan Winters' invention and industry are two things, two words that would describe his comedy very well. And I'm just glad that we will always have evidence in his comic performances on television, on film, and on radio and recording that will stay with us forever.
Murray Horowitz, thanks so much.
Thank you, Jerry. What an honor.
Murray Horowitz talking about his friend Jonathan Winters, who died on April 11th. According to the website jonathanwinters.com, the legendary comedian was surrounded by friends and family. That's it for this edition of Why So Weekend. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks to all our guests, and thank you for listening to member-supported 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at wyso.org. A broadcast service of Antioch University. Coming up next on WYSO, The Book Nook.